Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de la Región de Murcia. Pruebas específicas de certificación. Nivel C1. Convocatoria, junio 2020. Comprensión de textos orales.
Task 1.
Born in Moscow in 1914 to an Indian Muslim father and an American mother, Noor was raised in a profoundly peaceful home. Her parents were Sufi pacifists who put their faith in the power of music and compassion. They moved to Paris, where Noor studied child psychology and published children's books. But all this changed with the advent of the Second World War. In May 1940, with the German army ready to occupy Paris, Noor and her brother were faced with a difficult choice. As pacifists, they believed that all disputes should be settled non-violently, but witnessing the devastation across Europe, they decided that standing on the sidelines was not an option. Travelling to England, Noor volunteered for the Women's Auxiliary Air Force and trained as a radio operator. She immersed herself in wireless operations and Morse code, unaware that she was being monitored by a secret organisation. The British Special Operations Executive was established to sabotage the Germans in Nazi-occupied countries. As a trained radio operator who knew Paris well and spoke fluent French, Noor was an attractive recruit. In her interview, she was warned that wireless operation was some of the most dangerous work in the intelligence field. Operators had to lug a conspicuous transmitter through enemy territory, and the clandestine agency couldn't protect her if she was caught. Noor accepted her assignment immediately. While she was determined to take her pacifist principles as far as possible, Noor had to learn the art of espionage. She learned how to contact intelligence networks, pick a lock, resist interrogation, and fire a gun. In June 1943, she landed in Angers, south of Paris, and made her way to the city, armed with a false passport, a pistol, and a few French francs. But her network was compromised. Within a week of her deployment, all her fellow agents were arrested, and Noor was called home. She convinced her supervisors to let her stay, which meant doing the work of six radio operators single-handedly. Over the following months, she tracked and transported supplies to the French resistance, sent reports of Nazi activity back to London, and arrange safe passage for Allied soldiers. This work was essential to building the French resistance and Allied intelligence networks, and ultimately ending the war. Protected only by her quick thinking and charisma, she frequently talked her way out of questioning. When the Gestapo searched her on the train, she gave them a casual tour of her film projector. When an officer spotted her hanging her aerial, she chatted about her passion for listening to music on the radio and charmed him into helping her set up the cable. In her entire four-month tenure, her sharp wit and stealth never failed her. But her charm had inspired lethal jealousy. In October 1943, the sister of a colleague, in love with an agent that loved Noor, sold her address to the Gestapo. Noor refused to give away any information, focusing instead on her escape. Secreting a screwdriver away from the guards, they were able to loosen a skylight and slip out into the night. But just as her prisoners began to run for their lives, an air raid siren alerted her captors. Noor was caught once again and sent to a German prison. Then, on to Dachau concentration camp. Despite being tortured, deprived and isolated, Noor gave nothing away. In the moments before her execution, she is thought to have shouted, "Liberté!" Since her heroic sacrifice, Noor has been honoured as a hero who waged secret battles behind enemy lines, paving the way for freedom without ever taking a life. Born in Moscow in 1914 to an Indian Muslim father and an American mother, Noor was raised in a profoundly peaceful home. Her parents were Sufi pacifists who put their faith in the power of music and compassion. They moved to Paris, where Noor studied child psychology and published children's books. But all this changed with the advent of the Second World War. In May 1940, with the German army ready to occupy Paris, Noor and her brother were faced with a difficult choice. As pacifists, they believed that all disputes should be settled non-violently, but witnessing the devastation across Europe, they decided that standing on the sidelines was not an option. Travelling to England, Noor volunteered for the Women's Auxiliary Air Force and trained as a radio operator. She immersed herself in wireless operations and Morse code, unaware that she was being monitored by a secret organisation. The British Special Operations Executive was established to sabotage the Germans in Nazi-occupied countries. As a trained radio operator who knew Paris well and spoke fluent French, Noor was an attractive recruit. In her interview, she was warned that wireless operation was some of the most dangerous work in the intelligence field. Operators had to lug a conspicuous transmitter through enemy territory, and the clandestine agency couldn't protect her if she was caught. Noor accepted her assignment immediately. While she was determined to take her pacifist principles as far as possible, Noor had to learn the art of espionage. She learned how to contact intelligence networks, pick a lock, resist interrogation and fire a gun. In June 1943, she landed in Angers, south of Paris, and made her way to the city, armed with a false passport, a pistol and a few French francs. But her network was compromised. Within a week of her deployment, all her fellow agents were arrested and Noor was called home. She convinced her supervisors to let her stay, which meant doing the work of 6 radio operators single-handedly. Over the following months, she tracked and transported supplies to the French resistance, sent reports of Nazi activity back to London, and arranged safe passage for Allied soldiers. This work was essential to building the French resistance and Allied intelligence networks, and, ultimately, ending the war. Protected only by her quick thinking and charisma, she frequently talked her way out of questioning. When the Gestapo searched her on the train, she gave them a casual tour of her film projector. When an officer spotted her hanging her aerial, she chatted about her passion for listening to music on the radio and charmed him into helping her set up the cable. In her entire 4-month tenure, her sharp wit and stealth never failed her. But her charm had inspired lethal jealousy. In October 1943, the sister of a colleague, in love with an agent that loved Noor, sold her address to the Gestapo. Noor refused to give away any information, focusing instead on her escape. Secreting a screwdriver away from the guards, they were able to loosen a skylight and slip out into the night. But just as her prisoners began to run for their lives, an air raid siren alerted her captors. Noor was caught once again and sent to a German prison. Then, on to Dachau concentration camp. Despite being tortured, deprived and isolated, Noor gave nothing away. In the moments before her execution, she is thought to have shouted, "Liberté!" Since her heroic sacrifice, Noor has been honoured as a hero who waged secret battles behind enemy lines, paving the way for freedom without ever taking a life.
Task 2.
Our first expert witness is Sam Anderson, an American documentary maker who spent time getting to know one of the leaders of the Latin Kings, Antonio Fernandez, or to his followers, King Tone.
He's kind of short, kind of pale, but like really energetic, really talkative, always moving.
Is he intimidating at all?
No, not at all. I mean, he's like the easiest guy to hang out with. I mean, you think you're meeting with like the leader of one of the most notorious gangs in the world, but that was not my impression, no.
More on King Tone in a moment. First, Sam Anderson can tell us about the origins of the gang.
They began in Chicago in the 1950s. They were originally formed to protect against racial violence that was being experienced by Latino immigrants at that time.
Hundreds of people had arrived in Chicago from Puerto Rico to work as foundry and domestic workers, and they began to settle in a neighborhood where African Americans lived.
They're both impoverished communities living side by side, and so there are tensions, there are disagreements over turf, who gets to live where. And so essentially, Latinos felt vulnerable in the streets because they were already well-established gangs protecting different minorities, such as African Americans. And so the Latin Kings were sort of the very first Latino protection gang.
It wasn't just about protection. It was about identity, too.
So telling the members, you should be proud of your Latino heritage. We have tradition and culture, and these traditions should be cherished and celebrated.
They created a hierarchical structure. The leader was known as the Inca, and the gang was divided into neighborhood tribes. And over time, they developed rituals and emblems.
They have the crown as their symbol. They have the 5 points of the crown, which are their tenets.
Love, respect, sacrifice, honor, and obedience.
They have their hand symbols, they have their black and gold, and they even have this manifesto, and they call it the Bible. I've never seen it because I'm not a member and I'm not allowed to look at it. It's kind of mystical. It's very religious. They call it Kingism. It's this interesting ideology that's sort of part religion, part code of honor. And the highest ideal for a Latin king is somebody who looks beyond race and gender and believes all humans are equal and that we shouldn't be fighting with our fellow gang members, but we should all be fighting together against oppression.
Noble ideas, which were hard to live up to in practice.
It sort of quickly evolved into a criminal enterprise. Drug dealing, racketeering, prostitution. By the early 90s, they really are sort of a very feared criminal gang.
The Latin Kings split into two factions, one in Chicago and one in New York, under the notorious leadership of Luis Felipe, known as King Blood.
He was ruthless. He was in jail by 1990, and even though he was incarcerated, he was still leading the gang from within.
Ordering murders from his prison cell.
In the most sensational and terrifying incident, there was a member of the Latin Kings who was decapitated and his corpse was lit on fire.
The police started a major crackdown, and America's gang problems went to the top of the agenda of the president.
I'm announcing a major new effort to help the victims of crime, especially those who are the victims of gang violence. We've put in place an anti-crime strategy that is both tough and smart, putting 100,000 police on our streets, toughened penalties, banning...
President Clinton also brought in a new law to make it easier to deport criminals. Amid the chaos of all the arrests and deportations, a power vacuum formed, and out of it rose a new leader of the Latin Kings, King Tone, with a reformist agenda. Our first expert witness is Sam Anderson, an American documentary maker who spent time getting to know one of the leaders of the Latin Kings, Antonio Fernandez, or to his followers, King Tone.
He's kind of short, kind of pale, but like really energetic, really talkative, always moving.
Is he intimidating at all?
No, not at all. I mean, he's like the easiest guy to hang out with. I mean, you think you're meeting with like the leader of one of the most notorious gangs in the world, but that was not my impression, no.
More on King Tone in a moment. First, Sam Anderson can tell us about the origins of the gang.
They began in Chicago in the 1950s. They were originally formed to protect against racial violence that was being experienced by Latino immigrants at that time.
Hundreds of people had arrived in Chicago from Puerto Rico to work as foundry and domestic workers, and they began to settle in a neighborhood where African Americans lived.
They're both impoverished communities living side by side, and so there are tensions, there are disagreements over turf, who gets to live where. And so essentially, Latinos felt vulnerable in the streets because they were already well-established gangs protecting different minorities, such as African Americans. And so the Latin Kings were sort of the very first Latino protection gang.
It wasn't just about protection. It was about identity, too.
So telling the members, you should be proud of your Latino heritage. We have tradition and culture, and these traditions should be cherished and celebrated.
They created a hierarchical structure. The leader was known as the Inca, and the gang was divided into neighborhood tribes. And over time, they developed rituals and emblems.
They have the crown as their symbol. They have the 5 points of the crown, which are their tenets.
Love, respect, sacrifice, honor, and obedience.
They have their hand symbols, they have their black and gold, and they even have this manifesto, and they call it the Bible. I've never seen it because I'm not a member and I'm not allowed to look at it. It's kind of mystical. It's very religious. They call it kingism. It's this interesting ideology that's sort of part religion, part code of honor. And the highest ideal for a Latin king is somebody who looks beyond race and gender and believes all humans are equal and that we shouldn't be fighting with our fellow gang members, but we should all be fighting together against oppression.
Noble ideas, which were hard to live up to in practice.
It sort of quickly evolved into a criminal enterprise. Drug dealing, racketeering, prostitution. By the early 90s, they really are sort of a very feared criminal gang.
The Latin Kings split into two factions, one in Chicago and one in New York, under the notorious leadership of Luis Felipe, known as King Blood.
He was ruthless. He was in jail by 1990, and even though he was incarcerated, he was still leading the gang from within.
Ordering murders from his prison cell.
In the most sensational and terrifying incident, there was a member of the Latin Kings who was decapitated, and his corpse was lit on fire.
The police started a major crackdown, and America's gang problems went to the top of the agenda of the president.
I'm announcing a major new effort to help the victims of crime, especially those who are the victims of gang violence. We've put in place an anti-crime strategy that is both tough and smart, putting 100,000 police on our streets, toughened penalties, banning...
President Clinton also brought in a new law to make it easier to deport criminals. Amid the chaos of all the arrests and deportations, a power vacuum formed, and out of it rose a new leader of the Latin Kings, King Tone, with a reformist agenda.
Task 3.
All right. If you haven't been an avid exerciser, never fear. It's not too late necessarily. A recent study shows that if you take up routine exercises, even in late middle age, you can actually reverse some of the damage that a sedentary lifestyle does to your heart. Here's NPR's Patty Naiman.
By your mid-40s, your heart may start to show signs of aging, especially if you don't exercise regularly. Cardiologist Ben Levine.
The heart gets smaller and stiffer.
And eventually, it doesn't pump blood as efficiently as it used to, making some activities difficult.
The pressure inside the heart goes up really high, and the blood will back up into the lungs, making people very, very short of breath.
Levine studies exercise and fitness at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. He wanted to know if starting routine exercise in midlife or even later could prevent this decline in the heart. He recruited patients between 45 and 64 who were otherwise healthy but did not exercise. May Ansri was 62 at the time.
I have my hobbies. I do ballroom dancing, and in my leisure time that I like, and I do gardening.
Enjoyable, but not a daily routine.
No discipline.
Ansri was one of 53 volunteers in Levine's study who were divided into two groups. One did weightlifting and yoga 3 days a week. Ansri was in the other group, which did moderate to high-intensity exercise most days of the week. After 2 years, the group doing the more frequent, higher-intensity exercise saw dramatic improvements in heart health.
We took these 50-year-old hearts and turned the clock back to 30 or 35-year-old hearts.
Their hearts processed oxygen more efficiently and were notably less stiff.
And the reason that they got so much stronger and fitter was because their hearts now could fill much better and pump a lot more blood during exercise.
The hearts of those doing less regular exercise didn't change. For May Ansri, the study was life-changing. Today, she exercises every day of the week, walking and jogging at least 5 miles. If she misses a day, she says she just doesn't feel good, and it's helped her mental health, too.
I'm not moody. I mean, I'm happy.
A key part of the exercise regimen was interval training, short bursts of high-intensity exercise followed by a few minutes of rest. For example, Levine says this 4x4 interval training.
It's an old Norwegian ski team workout. It means 4 minutes at 95% of your maximal ability, followed by 3 minutes of active recovery, repeated 4 times.
Pushing as hard as you can for 4 minutes stresses the heart and forces it to function more efficiently. Levine says if you haven't done high-intensity exercise and decide to start, make sure you build up gradually. Cardiologist Nisa Goldberg, spokesperson for the American Heart Association, says Levine's findings are important.
Many studies that are done that look at cardiovascular health look at improvements in risk factors for heart attack and stroke, such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes. But this study specifically looked at heart function and how heart function can improve with exercise.
Goldberg says the findings are a great start, but the study was small and it needs to be repeated with far larger groups of people. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
All right. If you haven't been an avid exerciser, never fear. It's not too late necessarily. A recent study shows that if you take up routine exercises, even in late middle age, you can actually reverse some of the damage that a sedentary lifestyle does to your heart. Here's NPR's Patty Neiman.
By your mid-40s, your heart may start to show signs of aging, especially if you don't exercise regularly. Cardiologist Ben Levine.
The heart gets smaller and stiffer.
And eventually, it doesn't pump blood as efficiently as it used to, making some activities difficult.
The pressure inside the heart goes up really high, and the blood will back up into the lungs, making people very, very short of breath.
Levine studies exercise and fitness at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. He wanted to know if starting routine exercise in midlife or even later could prevent this decline in the heart. He recruited patients between 45 and 64 who were otherwise healthy but did not exercise. May Ansri was 62 at the time.
I have my hobbies. I do ballroom dancing, and in my leisure time that I like, and I do gardening.
Enjoyable, but not a daily routine.
No discipline.
Ansri was one of 53 volunteers in Levine's study who were divided into two groups. One did weightlifting and yoga 3 days a week. Ansri was in the other group, which did moderate to high-intensity exercise most days of the week. After 2 years, the group doing the more frequent higher-intensity exercise saw dramatic improvements in heart health.
We took these 50-year-old hearts and turned the clock back to 30 or 35-year-old hearts.
Their hearts processed oxygen more efficiently and were notably less stiff.
And the reason that they got so much stronger and fitter was because their hearts now could feel much better and pump a lot more blood during exercise.
The hearts of those doing less regular exercise didn't change. For May Ansri, the study was life-changing. Today, she exercises every day of the week, walking and jogging at least 5 miles. If she misses a day, she says she just doesn't feel good, and it's helped her mental health, too.
I'm not moody. I mean, I'm happy.
A key part of the exercise regimen was interval training, short bursts of high-intensity exercise followed by a few minutes of rest. For example, Levine says this 4x4 interval training.
It's an old Norwegian ski team workout. It means 4 minutes at 95% of your maximal ability, followed by 3 minutes of active recovery, repeated 4 times.
Pushing as hard as you can for 4 minutes stresses the heart and forces it to function more efficiently. Levine says if you haven't done high-intensity exercise and decide to start, make sure you build up gradually. Cardiologist Nisa Goldberg, spokesperson for the American Heart Association, says Levine's findings are important.
Many studies that are done that look at cardiovascular health look at improvements in risk factors for heart attack and stroke, such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes. But this study specifically looked at heart function and how heart function can improve with exercise.
Goldberg says the findings are a great start, but the study was small and it needs to be repeated with far larger groups of people. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
Fin de la prueba.